Parshas Tetzaveh is famous. It has a certain unique feature which is discussed by the Mefarshim, and that is, it is the only Parsha post the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu where his name is not mentioned. From the time that he comes on the scene in Parshas Shemos until the very end of Vezos HaBracha, Moshe is in every Parsha, with the exception of Parshas Tetzaveh. And this is something that has caught the attention of the Mefarshim. And there is a well-known idea that what's behind the absence of Moshe's name in this Parsha is the fact that it coincides with his Yahrzeit. He passed away on the 7th of Adar, and was also born on the 7th of Adar. He says he's 120 years Hayom. Hayom, says Rashi, Hayom mol u yomai ushnosai. And somehow, in recognition of that, because he passed away on the 7th of Adar, and Tetzaveh is always close to the 7th of Adar, as it is this year, is in almost every year, therefore the name of Moshe is missing. The question is, what exactly does this mean? As much as it's of significance that that's when he passed away, why does it lead to the absence of his name, so to speak, within the Parsha? And there's a very interesting comment which is found in the Sefer Oznaim LaTorah, which is written by one of the more recent Gedolim, Rav Zalman Sirotkin, the Rav of Lutsk. And he states that here the Torah is really showing itself to be quite different than other quote-unquote religions, whereby for them, and I have a feeling he had a particular one in mind, the day that their central personality is born becomes a central day of the religion, and then when he dies, that's another central day for the religion. There is no person who is more prominent in the history of Torah than Moshe Rabbeinu, and yet specifically on these days, when he was born and when he dies, he's de-emphasized. And the point is that there is no personality who is central in a religious sense. That is to say, a religion cannot grow around them in a day of religious significance. It cannot collect around them. Moshe's role, the subtotal of his role, which was historic and changed everything and gave us everything, but it was giving us Torah Hashem. He is 100% Hashem's emissary. Judaism focuses only around HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It doesn't focus around any individual. And therefore, dafka on the days when other people make whatever you would call it, a special day, a holy day, it's a normal day for us. And of all the weeks in the year, Moshe's name is dafka not mentioned. That's the very interesting comment of the Oznaim LaTorah. It brings to mind a famous explanation of the Vilna Gaon regarding a most unusual phenomenon, that on Seder night, Moshe's name is practically not mentioned through all of the Haggadah. And one would think, Im ein achshav ein masai, when would it be more appropriate to expand on the role of Moshe Rabbeinu, and his name is all but missing. It has one passing reference in a pasuk that's quoted for something else. We quote the pasuk of Vayaminu Bashem of Moshe Avdo. That's it. If you're looking for Moshe on Seder night, you will be disappointed. And the reason, says the Vilna Gaon, is exactly the same, because on all nights it is critical not to misunderstand the role of Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe didn't take us out of Mitzrayim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu took us out of Mitzrayim through Moshe. And all the things that Moshe did were purely as Hashem's emissary, and that vision is no more, never more important than on Seder night, and thus it results in Moshe's name being completely omitted on Seder night. It's interesting, as a follow-on comment, the Rambam, in the Halachas of Seder night, that's in Hilchos Chametz u'Matzah, in Perek Ches, and as we know, there is a mitzvah to talk to every child in keeping with the child's capacity. And that's why there's Keneged Arba Bonim Divra Torah, and there's the Tam, and there's the Chacham. And interestingly, Rambam illustrates the type of thing one should say to each type of child. For the Tam, he should say, you know, we were slaves, like so-and-so who's a slave, and then we were free. It's all about making it as tangible and relatable as possible. That's what the Tam can handle. For the Chacham, says Rambam, one develops and one elaborates on everything that happened and all the nisim that were performed for us through Moshe Rabbeinu. So it's interesting. The Haggadah doesn't mention Moshe Rabbeinu, but the Rambam does. But the point is, the Haggadah, shall we say, represents the lowest common denominator. It represents that which is for everyone. Moshe's role on Seder night is not for everyone, but the Rambam specifically brings him in as part of what you say to the Ben Chacham. Why is Moshe only part of the story for the Ben Chacham? Because he needs to be a Chacham in order to know how to absorb and how to place Moshe's role within the story. If he's less than a Chacham, he may misstep and ascribe essential power to Moshe, and therefore the role of Moshe within the story is left for the Ben Chacham. That's what we learned from the Rambam. But there is a deeper level, one may say, to this whole situation whereby Moshe's name goes missing in Parshas Tetzaveh in the week of his passing. It happens to be, and we find that it's always noted, almost always, the number of psukim within the parsha. When you get to the end, it will tell you how many psukim, and it gives you a siman also. Well, in fact, the only parsha which is on record as not having a siman is Parshas Pekudei, whereby it says there's 92 psukim, but doesn't give a siman. Rav Kook Zatzal explained, I heard this from my father many years ago, that the reason why, what did Pekudei do wrong, that it has no siman? There's always a siman that has the numerical value of those psukim. Originally, says Rav Kook, there was a siman for Pekudei also. Pekudei has 92 psukim, and the siman was Belikol. Belikol has a gematria of 92. However, the printers, and as we've mentioned many times, people in the printing business are not always in the thinking business, and they sometimes act a little hastily. So they saw the end, it says, Tzadik Beis Psukim, 92 Psukim, Beli Kol Siman, without any Siman. They thought that it means there's no Siman, so they just, from that point on, it was just 92. That's what the Chumash says, Beli Kol Siman. But in any case, aside from Pekudei, every Parsha has a Siman, and the Siman for Parsha's Tetzaveh is Michael. Michael has a numerical value of 101. But as we know, these simonim are chosen for a very specific reason. But what's Michael got to do with Parshas Tetzaveh? Michael is a malach, we're familiar with him, or either we are or we aren't. But how does he come to be specifically related to Parshas Tetzaveh? Well, it happens to be that he is. In next week's Parsha, Parshas Kisisa, we find there are a whole group of psukim accompanying the aftermath of the Egel, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you know, I'm going to send a malach before you, and he'll take you into Eretz Yisrael, and that's that. V'shalachti malach lefanecha. And as we see from Chazal and from the Rishonim, that was also part of, or in response to the Egel. As if to say, what is the alternative to Hashem sending a malach before us? That Hashem himself would go before us, and he will lead us, and he will be there. The notion that Hashem will send a malach to lead us represents a loosening somewhat of the connection between us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He's dealing with us through a malach. As we know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu deals with other nations through a malach. Each one has their sar, each one has their spiritual overseer. The Jewish people don't have such a thing. But that was what was being threatened, so to speak. That was what was being decreed. That's the implications of V'shalachti malachi lefanecha. A malach, and not direct, between us and Hashem. But that's why part of Moshe's tefillah at the time of the Egel, and there's many psukim about that tefillah, are not just that the Jewish people should be forgiven, but that that decree that that a malach should lead them should be rescinded. Im ein panecha olchos, al taleinu mizeh, halo belechtecha imanu, that you should be with us, and not through a malach. That Moshe was davening to, in a sense, get rid of the malach, which is coming in between them and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And indeed, Hashem said, accepted Moshe's tefillah, and the malach was taken away, and it was Hashem directly with Moshe. However, there is a follow-up to that episode, because as true as it is that the malach did not lead the Jewish people at that time, or more correctly, HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not lead them or guide them through a malach at that time, but it was not completely cancelled. It was deferred. It was deferred as long as Moshe was alive. HaKadosh Baruch Hu led the Jewish people directly. But when Moshe died and Yeshua took over, so then the malach came in. And that coincides with transitioning into life in Eretz Yisrael. And that, says the Midrash, is what is behind the episode which is recorded in the beginning of Sefer Yehoshua, very enigmatic episode. When Yeshua is in Yericho, so we're right in the beginning, he raises up his eyes, and what does he see? He sees an angel with a sword in his hand, and he says, Halanu ata imetzarenu, who are you? Are you with us? Are you with them? And he says, Ani sar tzava Hashem ata basi. I am the overseer of the army of Hashem. Now I have come. That's what the malach said to him. And what is the meaning of the words atobasi, now I've come? It means I was deferred. This was what was meant to happen as soon as they did the egel. Moshe davened, and I was taken out. But Moshe's died now, and you're in charge, and I'm back. Atobasi, now I've come. Ato with an ayin. That's what the Medrash says is what's behind that exchange. And who is this malach? This malach is Michael. Michael is referred to in the Navi Daniel. He is Hasar HaGadol. He is Sar Yisrael. We say Michael Sar Yisrael. All of this is somewhat abstract. With a malach, without a malach, what does it mean? What does it mean, it's in a sense, more practically? What it means is, as we know, life in the Midbar with Moshe Rabbeinu was an absolutely... divine presence was revealed, and there were miracles everywhere, and food came from the sky, and Be'er Shel Miriam, etc., and so forth. That's what happens when HaKadosh Baruch Hu deals with the Jewish people directly. But when he deals with them through a malach, through Michael Sar Yisrael, it really reflects a more hidden form of hashkacha, whereby the food is coming out of the ground now, and it's like everyone else, so to speak. However, they're being guided. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is guiding the forces of nature for the well-being and the success of Bnei Yisrael. And therefore, and this says the Vilna Gaon. So we see that without a malach, it's revealed hashkacha, and with a malach, it's concealed hashkacha. That's the transition from Moshe to Michael. Well, if Hashem is still guiding the Jewish people through nature, what is the concept of Hester Ponim? That already is somewhat concealed. It happens through natural events. What then is Hester Ponim? Hester Ponim is when what we call the concealment of the divine presence, absolutely, is when even natural events do not seem to be working well for the Jewish people. They seem to be left at the mercy of nature, and nature is not kind to them. That's a concealment. That's like in the time of Esther, Anochi Haster Astir. And indeed, there is a pasuk in Tehillim, Ayelas HaShachar, Tehillim Perek Kaf Beis, Lam Natzechel, Ayelas HaShachar, it starts by saying, Keili, Keili, Lama Azavtani. Why have you abandoned me? Keili, Keili, Lama Azavtani. And according to the Gemara, this is what Esther said in the depths of despair. And she's about to approach Achashverosh, and it looks like that all hope is lost, and she felt weak disconnected, and said, on behalf of the Jewish people, and said, Keili, Keili, Lama Azavtani. Tehillim Kaf Beis is the Shir Shel Yom, for those that have a special Shir, which is the Minig of the Vilna Gaon, for each special day. Tehillim Ayelas HaShachar is the Shir Shel Yom for Purim. Many of the Psukim are darshaned as a reference to the story of Esther. So she says, Keli, Keli, Lama Azavtani. And the Medrash comments on that. Why did she say that? Because she felt impoverished. Be'osa Sha'a Nasu Machvarash. What does Mach mean? Poor. Imachu Me'erkecha. V'chiyamuch Achicha. What is Rush? A poor person. Aniva Rush. The Jewish people at that time were impoverished. Machvarash. Says Reb Shimshon of Astropoli. What is the deeper meaning of saying the Jewish people at that time were Machvarash? The Jewish people have a natural connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as is expressed by the fact that the name Yisrael ends with Hashem's name, Yisrael. The Malach, through whom HaKadosh Baruch Hu guides nature for the Jewish people, also ends with El, as do all Malachim, not many, not all, most, let's say. Michael. Hester Ponim is when HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence seems removed from the Jewish people and removed from the forces of nature that he normally guides them with, and they seem to be just completely acting in random or even antagonistically towards the Jewish people. That's what happens when Yisrael, when the letters of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name, Keli, Yud, Lamed, and Aleph, are taken from Yisrael, you're left with Resh and Shin. And when those names again, those letters Yud, Aleph, and Lamed, Keli, are removed from Michael, you're left with Mem and Kaf. And that's why when the Pasuk says, Keli, Keli, Lama Azavtani, it reflects Esther feeling that the HaKadosh Baruch Hu's, the letters representing his name, Keli, Keli, have been removed from Yisrael and from Michael. And that's why the Medrash says, at that time, they were Mach Varash. Michael, all that was left was the Mem and the Kaf from Yisrael. All that was left was the Shin and the Resh. But when we're not in Hester Ponim, in principle, it is a way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu guides the Jewish people through nature. And this brings us to a well-known statement of the Gemara. We're not formally in Purim yet, but it's in the air already, and it is Adar. And the Gemara states that when Haman drew his famous lot, he peeled Pur, after which the festival is named, and it came out in Adar. So on the one hand, it must have been slightly frustrating for Haman, because he's in Nisan, so Adar cannot be further away. It's a long time away. But, says the Gemara, but Haman felt it was worth the wait. Because even though from Nisan to Adar is 12 months, but Adar is a good month for him and a bad month for the Jewish people. Why? Says the Gemara, because it's the month that Moshe died. So he was happy. He was happy with Adar. However, says the Gemara, he didn't know that Adar is also the month that Moshe is born. Because Moshe was born and died on the same day. So he was a bit of a Talmud Chacham, but not enough. And he knew enough to make him happy, but not enough to make him upset. Which was good for us. But the question is, and again, I think the Gemara is well known, but what's the meaning of this? It's when Moshe dies, and that's good for him, but it's also when he's born, so then that ruins everything for him. I mean, Moshe still died in Adar. The fact that he was born in Adar doesn't mean he didn't die in Adar. How does that take it away? And obviously, it's a very delicate discussion. But the Maharal explains that the difference between a month where Moshe just dies there or is born and dies there is that, after all, until further notice, everyone leaves the world at a certain point. But the notion that HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes a tzaddik from the world on the day that he was born represents an element of completion. In other words, the circle is closed, right? The circle and cycle is closed, and that means it's a davar sholeh. The difference between something that stops before it runs its cycle is that if it stops at that point, it's a cessation. But if it comes back full circle, and that's when it ends, that's not cessation, that's completion. And what is the difference between these two ways of looking at it? Why is Haman happy when he hits the month that Moshe dies? Because he knows that Moshe, he knows history, and that Moshe represents HaKadosh Baruch Hu's connection with the Jewish people. They were never more connected than in Moshe's time. So the departure of Moshe, the passing of Moshe, represents the end of that connection. And as soon as that connection is ended, so then Haman can enter and do with them as he wishes. And that's why when he saw that Moshe died in that month, it's bad for the Jewish people because their connection is terminated, and good for Haman because enter Haman. So what does he not appreciate? That this is also the month that Moshe was born, which means that even though he died in this month, but he died at the end of a circle, and therefore it was simply a time now, his role had been completed, and it was time to transition into another form of relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. As if to say, the critical question is, the way that Hashem related to us in Moshe's time, that stopped after Moshe, but the relationship didn't stop. It just transitioned into another form of relationship, which was through Michael, Sar Yisrael, through the forces of nature, as indeed is the story of Purim, where all the forces of nature and all the episodes and the various component parts were maneuvered and manipulated by HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the benefit of the Jewish people and for the downfall of Haman. That's where he took a wrong step. He felt that the relationship was over. It wasn't over. It had just changed into a different type of relationship, no less frustrating for Haman in the end. And indeed, this morning, I came across a very interesting drosha. There is a sefer called Kehilas Yitzchak, which is a collection of Divrei Torah from Gaonim of Vilna. There's only one Gaon of Vilna, but there were a lot of Gaonim there, smaller G. And one of them was actually called Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. He became well known as Rabbi Jacob Joseph, who then went to New York. And he started out in Vilna. And the Sefer Kehilos Yitzchak says a very wonderful thing. Again, the Gemara says that Haman sees that Moshe died in Adar, and he's happy. But he didn't know he was born, and if he knew that, he wouldn't have been so happy. So what does it mean? Says Rav Yaakov Yosef, the birth and the death of Moshe reflect these two types of relationship, or these two types of interaction from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to the world. How so? By the time that Moshe dies, it's all open miracles, and Moshe is fully functional till the end, and all those miracles continue to the end, and his very burial is miraculous, and no one knows where he's buried, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself buried him, and it's all... it's all high-profile, revealed miracles. That's the parting of Moshe. And therefore, when that goes, it sounds like there's nothing else. But it isn't true. Adar is also the month of the birth of Moshe. Well, what does that reflect? Says Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, the events accompanying the birth of Moshe are very different than those that accompanied his death. His death was fully miraculous, as we've described. But his birth was not, in the sense that, as one reads the psukim, and Moshe's life is in danger from the beginning, because ben hayilod hayaoret hashlichuhu, and there's a decree out to kill all the Jewish male children, and Moshe is part of that. And the only thing that can happen, and Yocheved just, she hides him, and she can't hide him anymore. So she makes that little basket for him, she puts it on the Nile, and all of this is really what we would call hishtadlus. I mean, she's just trying to save him. And in the end, HaKadosh Baruch Hu intervenes, but he doesn't intervene by splitting the Nile or swooping up Moshe and delivering him safely somewhere else. But rather, it's once again a maneuvering of events. It's Batya comes, and she sees him, she takes him, she brings him to Paris Palace. In fact, one almost feels a kind of like a Megillas Esther feeling at that time, because it's just the right person at the right place, and brought in, and who would have thought, and there he is, and he grows up in, like, you know, Esther is in Ahasuerus's palace, and Moshe's in Pyro's palace, and it's just the way that it worked out, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu orchestrated it. As if to say, the Jewish people in the time of Purim cannot hope to be helped much by the way things were when Moshe died. because they can't hope for an open miracle, but they can hope for a great deal about how things were when Moshe was born. And Haman didn't factor that in, and therefore he saw Adar as a good month for him. It's not a good month for him, because it's the month where Moshe not only died, but also was born. And in the end, the Jewish people were saved by a miracle very similar to the one that occurred when Moshe himself was born. Very interesting interpretation of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. What we do see, however, is that coming back to Parshas Tetzaveh and Moshe's name, is it mentioned for reasons that we said, this is the week that he died, and therefore everything that's represented by things as they were run when Moshe was alive, that terminates. But as it does, the relationship doesn't stop, it just moves. And therefore in the very Parsha where Moshe's name isn't there, the other relationship is already alluded to. In the number of psukim, which is 101, the siman for which is Michael, who comes in as Michael Sar Yisrael with the departure of Moshe. So these are some very fascinating points to ponder with regards to the well-known phenomenon of the missing name of Moshe from Parshas Tetzaveh. Well, having spoken in introduction of the Parsha, let's begin the Parsha itself. Perek Kaf Zayin, Pasuk Kaf. Ve'ata tetzaveh, you, this is Hashem talking to Moshe, not mentioned as we said, by name, you command B'nai Yisrael, ve'ikru elecha, Shemen Zayizach, Kasisla Ma'or, they should bring to you this pure olive oil, Lahalos Ner Tomid, to raise the lights, the oil for the menorah. And it's interesting, again, we're familiar with the first pasuk, and there's a lot to take for granted. I mean, why is it specified that the oil for the menorah should be brought to Moshe? As far as we know, all the things that were materials that were dedicated and contributed to the Mishkan were brought to Moshe, but there's a specific connection seemingly being formed between the oil for the lighting and Moshe, the Yikru Elecha. What is behind that special relationship? And the Meshech Chachma has a very wonderful interpretation here. The word Elecha, Yikru Elecha, they shall take to you, as we said, seemingly redundant. Everything was taken to Moshe initially. But Elecha, says Meshech Chachma, has the connotation of not only to you, but for you. That is to say, for your benefit. Very similar to what Rashi says in the beginning of Lech Lecha. Lech Lecha is letovasecha. It's good for you. You'll benefit from this. And that means that somehow the oil for the light was a particular benefit to Moshe. Why? Says Meshech Chachma, you know, it's a very interesting comment of the Ibn Ezra. In the beginning of Parshas Baalosecha, which is the third and final time where the menorah is mentioned in the Torah, Baalosecha Saneros, and Ibn Ezra comments on the fact that at the beginning of Baalosecha, following immediately on from the end of Parshas Noso, the final pasuk in Parshas Noso describes HaKadosh Baruch Hu talking to Moshe. I mean, that's the end of Noso. Uvavo, Moshe, El Oel, Moed, Vayishma, Esakol, Mibein HaKruvim, Midaber, Elav. It's the final pasuk in Noso is about Hashem speaking to Moshe. And then the next thing we hear is lighting the menorah. Ma inyan menorah, Eitzel Moshe. How do these two form a continuum? But the answer, says Ibn Ezra, is in the Mechilta. For the Mechilta says that, based on Psukim, in Shemos and elsewhere, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's communication with Moshe was specifically by day. It's very interesting. And it's in contrast with every other Navi, where we say Bachaloma Daberbo, it will always tend to be at night, unless he's kind of put to sleep during the day or enters into that kind of trance-like state. But most Nevi'im are at night, but Moshe is by day. B'yom diber Hashem el Moshe. It happens by day. And the Ibn Ezra explains that in keeping with the unique nature and level of prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu, it needed the light that accompanies the day. Wisdom and insight is always associated with light. HaChochma Ta'ir, and Moshe's level of Nevuah specifically happened during the day, because the day is a time of light. And now, says Ibn Ezra, if that's true, if it's about the light, then perhaps it's not tied to day as opposed to night. It just has to be light and not dark. And that's why after the end of Nosa, which describes Hashem talking to Moshe, Mibein HaKruvim, which is that very special level of communication between Hashem and Moshe, and as we know, only happened during the day, but the Pasuk goes on to say, but light the menorah. The very next pasuk, Balosach HaSaneros, talk to Aaron, Balosach HaSaneros, tell him to light the menorah. Why? Says Ibn Ezra, because when Aaron lights the menorah, that means there's light in the Mishkan, and Moshe can have that communication with Hashem even by night. That's the Smichus Psukim, says Ibn Ezra. Very interesting comment altogether. Well, says Meshe Chochma, now we understand why the Moshe has a special interest or a special involvement in receiving the oil for the menorah, because the oil for the menorah is of direct benefit to Moshe, because when the menorah burns through the night, Moshe at that time can receive nevuah as well. And that is alluded to in the words, v'yikhu eilecha. Eilecha means not only to you, but for you. It will be beneficial for you, because lahalos ner tamid, and then he can receive his unique nevuah day and night. That's Pasuk Aleph. The Meshech Chochma is only halfway through, because the very next pasuk says, "Be'ol Moed Michutz LaParoches Asher Al Eidos." It will be in the Mishkan outside the Paroches. Yaroch Oso Aron Uvanav Me'erah Boker Lefnei Hashem. They shall arrange it from evening to morning, and then the pasuk concludes, "Chukas Olam LeDorosam." It shall be, we would translate, an everlasting statute for their generations. Chukas Olam LeDorosa. Now, what is the meaning of those words? We understand that here the Torah is somehow establishing the menorah as a chok, and it's an everlasting chok, and it's more or less straightforward. But the Meshech Chochma says, Chukas Olam LeDorosa means it is an everlasting statute for their generations. There's an inference there, and that is, in the future, Lederosam, for future generations, it will be a chok, implying currently it's not. But why not? Well, what is a chok? Says the Meshech Chochma. As we know, a chok is a mitzvah that serves no rational purpose or purpose that reason can grasp. It's super rational. Is that true of the menorah? Generally, yes, because Hashem doesn't need the light. As the Gemara states in Perek Bamei Madlikin, V'chila Orahu Tzarech, does Hashem need the light? On the contrary, He gives light to everyone else, and therefore it remains a chok, it's a sign that the Shekhinah is among Bnei Yisrael. Very nice, that's a chok. because no rational or reasonable purpose is served by the illumination itself. Says Meshech Chochma, that's true in future generations, but it's not true now. Because as we saw in the first pasuk, Moshe benefits from that light. It's Eilecha, because when it's light, he can receive communication from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, the first two psukim, both about the menorah, are actually contrasted with each other. Pasuk Aleph is the function that it serves for Moshe, in Moshe's time. Pasuk Beis, it will then become a chok for future generations where that purpose is no longer served and a reason can no longer be fathomed. That's what the second pasuk says, Chukas Olam LeDorosa. And what is so fascinating about this comment of Meshech Chochma is that we discover that we're familiar with certain different categories of mitzvahs. There's chukim, and there's mishpatim, and there's mitzvahs, and there's edus, and there's a couple of others. Different categories of mitzvahs. But what we see from Meshech Chochma and other mefarshim state likewise in different contexts, that sometimes you can have a mitzvah that actually shifts category at a certain point. That means it starts out in one, and then it becomes another. Normally, paraduma, for example, it's a chok from beginning to end, and mishpatim from beginning to end. But what about the menorah? It's hard to say, because currently, it's not a chok. It has a reason given by the Torah. But subsequently, it becomes a chok, and it shifts department in mitzvahs. That's a chiddush. That's one for the books, that a mitzvah can actually shift category within mitzvahs. All of this is within the comment of Meshech Chochma on these opening two psukim. There is a very beautiful idea which is found in the writings of the Ksav Sofer, just a reflection on the menorah before we move on to other matters. The menorah, as we know, is a symbol for Torah, Ner Mitzvah, Torah Or. And the Ksav Sofer says there's a very beautiful idea that we see from within the menorah itself. Rabbi Yehuda Anossi is famous for saying that he learned a lot from his teachers. Harbe lamadati merabosai. And v'yose michaveroi, but I learned more from my colleagues. Umitalmida yose mikulam. And from my students, I learned most of all. That's what Rabbi Yehuda Anossi said. Clearly, everything needs to be taken in context. What type of students are we talking about? But it can happen that through, when he's already in the teaching stage, and then the students, and they question, and the way that it needs to be explained to them, it brings everything to a completely higher level of crystallization. Mitalmida yose mikula. An interesting feature of the menorah is that, as we know, the middle light stayed lit continually. That's the Ner Tomid. The sixth would have burnt out by morning, but the middle one kept on going until the next evening. So much so that they actually had to put it out in order to relight it, because there's a mitzvah to light all seven. But the way that they would do that, and it became a chain in a sense, is that they would prepare all the other six, and then they would light them from the middle one, which was still going. And then all six had been lit, and then the only one that you needed to light now was the middle one, which they would then put out, and then they would light it from one of the other six. That's how it goes. So it starts out that you light the other six from the middle one, and then subsequently the middle one is lit from one of the other six. Says the Ksav Sofer, what is the menorah? It's the middle, and all of the other branches are facing inwards. That's a Rebbe and his Talmidim. And that's how Torah is taught. And he's in the middle, and they're all around. And now the question is, well, who lights whom? And who illuminates whom? And the answer is, there's two stages. Stage one, they all receive their illumination from the middle. All the Talmidim receive from the Rebbe. But then something else happens. It reaches a point where the Rebbe then gets relit by one from the side. That's mitamida yose mikulam. He himself receives greater illumination from one of those that he initially illuminated. That's the allusion to that idea within the halacha of the menorah. Very beautiful idea from the Ksav Sofer. Well, let's move now to discuss one of the big dekehuna, and that is the me'il. Let's see where that is in the psukim. It's in Perek Kafches, pasuk Lamed Aleph. V'asisa es me'il ha'ifod k'dil techeles. As we know, a regular Kohen Gadol has four garments, a regular Kohen has four garments, and the Kohen Gadol has an extra four, and one of those extra four is the me'il. V'asisa es me'il ha'ifod k'dil techeles. It is pure techeles. And then pasuk lamed beis says vaya pi rosho besocho. It talks about the opening of rosho. And here we have an interesting discussion amongst Rishonim as to what did the Me'il look like. Rashi and Rambam. For Rashi, the Me'il was closed. That is to say, it was something that he would put his head through, but then it was closed on the sides. It had sleeves. But that means that it had two openings, essentially, because one at the top, the narrow one, and then at the bottom, surrounding his feet, but it was closed. Pi Rosho means the opening at the top, because there were two. Whereas the Rambam understands that there was only one opening. It only had the opening for the head, but it was completely open at the sides. So Pi Rosho is the only hole in the Me'il, which is where he put his head through, but it was completely open down the sides, like a poncho, I guess we would say. So that's an interesting machlokas, how to understand Pi Rosho. The higher of the two openings for Rashi, because the whole thing is closed around the sides, or there is only really one opening, it's completely open at the side. And as we can appreciate, and we are in the realm of mitzvahs, and big tikkun are mitzvahs, halachic discussions are quick to follow. Specifically, the Minchas Chinuch raises a question. Namely, and it will be a question for Rambam, as we'll appreciate. It sounds a lot like the Me'il is a garment with four corners that is open on both sides. And we're familiar with that type of idea. It's called a talis. And a talis with four corners requires tzitzis. And this then is the interesting question of the Minchas Chinuch. Does the Me'il need tzitzis? I mean, nowhere does a person need to keep mitzvahs more than in the Beis HaMikdash, and he's the Kohen Gadol. It's not a time to be remiss about these things. So you have one of the begadim. It looks exactly like a talis. For Rashi, it's not a question, because for Rashi, it's closed at the sides. And there's something that's closed at the sides, maybe it had no corners. And even if it did, they're just marginal, and there's no question of tzitzis. But for Rambam, it's open. It's mamish like a talis, just much longer than a normal pair of tzitzis. But says Minchas Chinuch, I've never heard anyone say that the Me'il had tzitzis, but I wonder why. After all, it looks like it fits the bill. So the Minchas Chinuch gives a rather straightforward answer to this question, and that is that in order for a garment to be obligated in tzitzis, it needs to belong to the individual. It could be, says the Minchas Chinuch, that the Bigdei Kahuna did not belong to the Kohen Gadol. He had license to wear them for avoda purposes, but they're not his. They belong to the Beis HaMikdash. And there are halachic discussions about that. If he uses them for his own needs, it might even be Me'ila, which is misappropriating temple property. And therefore, because the Kohen Gadol and no human being actually owns the Me'il, perhaps therefore, at least on a Torah level, there was no obligation of tzitzis. V'asu lahem tzitzis. It needs to belong to them. The Me'il doesn't belong to the Kohen Gadol. Simple answer of the Minchas Chinuch. A rather more intriguing answer to this question comes from the Radziner Rebbe, Reb Gershon Helich Lehner, who was the Rebbe of Radzin in the 1800s, and he was famous amongst other things because he felt that he had discovered the Tcheles. And he wrote three volumes on the subject of the Tcheles. The first one was called Eina Tcheles. And as we've mentioned in previous occasions, the discussion of Tcheles was not just for tzitzis. Well, in our experience, it revolves around the tzitzis, but it was also for Bigdei Kahuna. When the whole question of perhaps restarting the Korbanos came along, Korbanos need Bigdei Kahuna, and Bigdei Kahuna need Tcheles, which means that the Bigdei Kahuna were also discussed really a lot within the context of this question. Okay. Says the Radziner Rebbe, if you look in the Zohar, in its discussion of the Me'il, So it talks about what was on the hem of the Me'il. And what was on the hem of the Me'il? As the Pasuk describes, and let's see, Pasuk Lamed Gimel, Va'asisa al Shulav. So make on the hem, Rimunei Tcheles V'argaman V'Tolas Shani al Shulav Saviv. You should make those pomegranates made out of materials on its hem, Saviv, all around. Ufamunei Zahav B'socham Saviv. And also bells of gold in them, saviv, or in between them, saviv. That's an interesting machlokus between Rashi and Ramban. How exactly were the bells and the pomegranates configured, one vis-a-vis the other? According to Rashi, they alternated. There was a pomegranate and a bell, and you had just one after the other until you went all the way around. So besocham means in between them, according to Rashi. But according to Ramban, Besocham means inside of them. He understands that the bells are actually inside the pomegranate. Slightly different understanding. The Maharal in the Gur Aryeh says that the reason why he feels that Rashi is understanding is correct is because according to the Ramban, if the bells are inside the pomegranate, then having already said that the Rimonim need to be Saviv, you don't need to say that the pamonim, the bells, need to be saviv, because if there's one inside every pomegranate, it's saviv, because it's inside something that's itself saviv. But if they're separate things, you need to be told that it's besocham in between, but it needs to be placed all around, alternately. Okay, in any case, that's Rashi and Ramban, but the point is, you have this very interesting pertinence to the Me'il. You have these rimonim made of wool. Says the Zohar, These rimonim are, and I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, lekoval kanfei mitzvah. They parallel the corners of mitzvah. Says the Ratzina Rebbe, it appears that what the Zohar is saying is that on this unique garment called the Me'il, it did have tzitzis, but it had a unique type of tzitzis. They were the rimonim. The woolen threads that made up the pomegranates, which were all around the hem, they were the tzitzis for the me'il. Lekabel kanfei mitzvah means this corresponds, this parallels the corner of a mitzvah, which he explains to mean that parallel to any other four-corner garments which need tzitzis for the mitzvah, but here the pomegranates formed that function. They were the tzitzis of the me'il. Very interesting explanation. And interestingly, the Ksava Kabbalah explains in a very similar vein that the bells were, as it says, v'nishma kola b'vo'o l'kodesh, that they were in order that he should be heard. What does it mean? Says the Ksava Kabbalah, the Torah requires a person to have tzitzis on the corners of their garment. Why? Because you should see them and remember the mitzvahs. Says Ksava Kabbalah, your average person is required to do mitzvahs and requires the reminder of the tzitzis for them to do the mitzvahs. No one needs a greater reminder to act appropriately and correctly and loftily than the Kohen Gadol, who represents the entire Jewish people, and he has so much else that he's involved in. And therefore, says the Ksava Kabbalah, for most people, a visual reminder is enough. Ureisem oso. Because the Kohen Gadol, he also needs ushamatem oso. Not only something that catches the eye on the hem of a garment, representing all that tzitzis does, but also he needs to be reminded as he moves. And sometimes something that you hear, it's easier to evoke awareness than something that you see. Because if you're not looking, you don't see, but you always hear. So once again, it fits in very, very nicely with what the Balat Cheles is saying, is that together the Pamonim and Rimonim fulfilled a function of a very special type of tzitzis for the Me'il of the Kohen Gadol. And then the Ratzina Rebbe, who hasn't finished yet, he has one final comment, which is really quite fascinating. And that is, it could be, not only are these rimonim, we're calling them, they're the tzitzis for the me'il, with their unusual type of tzitzis, it could be that at least in one respect, they actually set the tone for all tzitzis. How so? I've never seen a person with pomegranates for their tzitzis. There is quite a well-known hidur within the mitzvah of tzitzis. How many threads does each of the threads of the tzitzis need to be made from? It's got to be more than one, because it has to be twined, wound around each other, each individual thread. But two is enough. But there is a hidur. It's quite a well-known thing. It's called kafel shmona, where each thread, that is to say, each of the eight threads of the tzitzis of each corner itself is made up of eight threads. So each thread is eight threads. Where does it come from? Two is fine, and if a person does more, but it comes to rest specifically at eight. Says the Ratzina Rebbe, if you look in the Rambam, in Hilchos Klei HaMikdash, when he describes the me'il and the pomegranates at the hem of the me'il, and as we know, each one in its own way, the threads were made up of multiple threads, sometimes six, sometimes more, sometimes less. The threads of the pomegranate, says Rambam, were each made up of eight threads. And therefore, the Rebbe suggests that it could be that the idea of being mehader, that the threads of the tzitzis are kafel shmona, are made up of eight, is because they take their cue from the, in a sense, the ultimate tzitzis, which are the rimonim, the hem of the me'il, where they had to be made of eight. That's already an integral part of the mitzvah. Our tzitzis are not like that, but they do reflect it, and that he suggests is the basis for this hidur of kafel shmona. Very interesting indeed. Well, the Torah itself describes the the function of these bells in Pasuk Lamed Hei. The Haya al Aaron Lesharis, the Me'il shall be on Aaron when he performs the Avoda, Vinishma Kolo Bevo'o El HaKodesh. And his voice, its sound will be heard, the sound of, as he approaches the Kodesh. And of course, the Pshat is because you'll hear the sound of bells as he moves, as he approaches. Vinishma Kolo Bevo'o El HaKodesh. Says the Al Shech HaKodesh, and as we know, all of the elements of the Mishkan and all of the component parts of the Big Day Kahuna, they're there to teach us something. They're there to be pondered and to be for lessons to be absorbed. Specifically, the Gemara states in two places that the Big Day Kahuna were all mechaper, each one for a certain Aveira. Each one provided atonement for a certain Aveira. As Mefarshim explained, you have to learn the lesson from that garment and then hopefully avoid the Aveira, and then you're on your way to atonement. What about the Me'il? Says the Gemara, the Me'il provides atonement for, or aids in atoning for, Lashon Hara. Let the sound of the bells come and atone for Lashon Hara. Okay, certainly much to discuss about that, but that's what the Gemara says. Now the Zohar HaKadosh says a very striking statement. But the explanation of which is actually quite straightforward. And that is, says the Zohar, if a person uses his mouth for Lashon Hara, to speak ill of others, to profane his mouth with Lashon Hara, so the prayers that come out of his mouth are not accepted. It's an application of the principle of Ein Kategor Naaseh Senegor. The prosecution cannot be the offense. If it cannot be the defense, if he spends his time using his mouth to accuse others, it cannot then arbiter for his behalf. So says the Zohar. In fact, the Sefer Marpe Loshon, written by one of the greats of the 1700s, Rebbe Froel HaKohen of Hamburg, explains that is why the very first thing that we do as soon as we finish Shmona Esrei proper, which is the quintessence of davening, is the end of the Shmona Esrei itself. The very next extra supplication we ask is to be aided in avoiding Lashon Hara. Where did that come in? What's it got to do with davening? Says the Marpe Loshon, according to the Zohar, it has everything to do with davening, because that is really what will all go well for a person's prayers to be accepted. It's the most important thing to say as soon as a person's davening. In fact, in this regard, of course, no discussion of Lashon Hara is complete without some input from the Chofetz Chaim. The Pasuk says, with regards to the Metzora, as he leaves town, says, V'tomei tomei yikra. He calls out that he's tomei. And of course, the pshat is, he says he's tomei so the people will stay away from him. But the Gemara says, he proclaims that he's tomei because he's saying, daven for me. That's how the Gemara explains in Masechet Shabbos and Daf Samach Zayin, Samach Vav. Modia tzara l'rabim, he lets everyone know because he's saying daven for me. Says the Chofetz Chaim, if you're aware that you have a problem, why are you asking other people to daven for you? Why don't you daven for yourself? But the Chofetz Chaim says, based on the Zohar, we understand that until he's confronted the problem of Lashon Hara, he doesn't have the option of davening for himself. He needs to ask other people to do it for him, because he is in the category of Ein Kategor Naaseh Senegor until further notice. It's quite an interpretation of the Chofetz Chaim. And all of this, says the Al Shech HaKodesh, is alluded to, as we said, in our Pasuk, because the Gemara states that the Me'il is a kapara for Lashon Hara. And what is the effect of that? Says the Pasuk, Vayal Aaron Lasharis, it shall be an Aaron. Vinishma kolo bevo'o lakodesh. His voice shall be heard when he enters the Kodesh. The pshat of the pasuk is that its voice, meaning its sound, the sound of the Me'il with all of its bells, will be heard. That's the pshat. But there have been two nouns mentioned in the pasuk. It will be an Aaron. Vinishma kolo doesn't just mean its sound will be heard, it means his voice will be heard, referring to Aaron. How so? because Aaron represents the Jewish people. He has a voice. He'll be asking for things. But will his voice be heard? It depends on one thing. If he wears the me'il and learns the lesson from the me'il and avoids Lashon Hara and atones for Lashon Hara, then v'nishma kolo b'vo'a lakodesh. So it's an interesting and I think meaningful way to pause our discussion. On the one hand, the Bigdei Kahuna, they're for one person, and we currently don't have them, and therefore the certain parts of the parsha seem somewhat remote, but they're not. The lesson from the Me'il is as important for us nowadays as it was when the Beis HaMikdash was here, all the more important, in fact, because it is a very respectable part of what will enable us to get all of this back, certainly food for thought. We'll leave it over there.